Man, I've been up here often enough. I don't normally get nervous, but I'm feeling a little like jittery this morning. Maybe too much coffee. I'm gonna blame it on daylight savings. So thank you all for being here on time. Greetings to everyone tuning in online. It's good to be with you all here this morning. Whether here in person or digitally from afar. So today we're continuing in our Beatitudes series. In case you're new to the series, the Beatitudes, as they are popularly known in the New Testament book of Matthew, function as the introduction to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which is most likely a composite of like core teachings from his ministry. And the Beatitudes, as we've seen over the past couple months, are a series of declarations of blessedness that describe, as the title of this teaching series suggests, the shape of the kingdom. Is that still up there? Yeah. So what does life aligned with the heartbeat of God look like? How do we start on the journey of following Jesus? The Beatitudes, I think, are really helpful for finding our way through these questions. So today, our text, the next Beatitude we're doing, I think is a quite timely one for the moment in which we find ourselves, and perhaps timely for those of you who struggled with losing an hour of sleep and woke up this morning and chose violence, as they say. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Now, I want to confess right out of the gate here that I personally have a little bone to pick with Jesus on this one. Because if this verse was just a little bit different, if Jesus had just changed one word, well, actually just part of one word, I would be a shining example of this beatitude. You can go to the next slide. If Jesus had just said, "Blessed are the peacekeepers, those who keep peace," I could tell you all about how to do that well. Because I hate conflict. I avoid it at all costs. If you're an Enneagram person, I lead with the 9 filter, which means that I have this. There's a lot of 9s around here in this community. So you guys know, but I have this intense desire to maintain a sense of inner peace and harmony and to avoid conflict or other emotional disturbances. So because of that, I'm pretty darn good at peacekeeping. But of course, that isn't what Jesus says here, is it? But as I've been sitting with this text in preparation for today's teaching, I kept thinking, I think there's something here. So often, peacekeeping gets mistakenly kind of valued or practiced instead of peacemaking. And I know, again, I'm not the only one who has this tendency. And so I actually want to start this morning first by talking about what I'm going to call the false way of peacekeeping before getting into what I think Jesus meant by blessed are the peacemakers. So if you're taking notes, I don't often do this, but there's two parts to my message today. I'll give you a big picture outline there. So I've titled part one, The False Way of Peacekeeping. Now, when it comes to peacekeeping, I think there are two, I would say, equal but opposite errors that get made here. And the first is a form of peacekeeping that is basically appeasement. It's not so much about peacemaking as peace maintaining. It's the posture that says, don't rock the boat, that tries to smooth things over when conflict or trouble happens by doing whatever it takes, sometimes pretty extreme lengths, to silence or ignore the issue at hand rather than deal with it. It seeks peace through accommodation or compliance, even when injustice or oppression are present. And this can happen at the individual or the collective level. And just for the sake of transparency, I'll give you a recent example by way of confession from my own life. Last weekend, I was in my hometown of Bakersfield for my brother's wedding. And the first night I was there after the rehearsal dinner, I was hanging out with several of my family members, some of whom were visiting from Arizona, from Tucson. And one of my other relatives, someone who holds a place of authority in a lot of ways in our family, asked these family members from Tucson if they ever saw any illegals walking around. Yeah. Now, up until that point, we hadn't been talking about politics. This was a totally kind of unprovoked, out-of-the-blue comment. And when a few of us kind of laughed uncomfortably, the same relative went on to say that they favored racial profiling in some cases to identify illegal immigrants. I'm using their terms. Okay, now we can have a healthy debate about immigration policy, the best way to approach that as a nation, but my point here, I believe, and as I kind of sense from a lot of you just feeling the reaction in the room, I think this kind of language, those illegals, is inherently derogatory. It's demeaning and not at all in line with how God calls us to treat the stranger and the foreigner. So I was frankly disgusted and pretty deeply grieved that this person I loved would say something like that. But in the moment, I didn't say anything. I just sat there quietly until the conversation shifted to something else. I kept the peace. Now, of course, there's room for discernment here about when and how to have these conversations, when to speak up, things like that. I was there for a wedding weekend, so there was maybe it wasn't the right time. But I don't know, I think about that, and I just know my passivity in that moment sure as heck wasn't the peacemaking of today's beatitude that Jesus has in mind here. And I'm willing to bet that most, if not all of us, have seen something similar play out in their own family systems, in your own communities. The need for someone, or for many people, to play the peacekeeping role to keep a family stable is really, really powerful. But as any therapist worth their salt will tell you, right, it's so, so damaging. And it's not just racist remarks that this false peacekeeping provides cover for. It enables abuse of all kinds. Silence, gaslighting, deceitfully worded comments for the sake of protecting reputations, families, communities, and even churches. People are afraid to bring the harm that's happening into the light because they want to keep the peace. And it's so easy, it's so tempting, right, to justify that. There are many places where the biblical text speaks out powerfully against this false peacekeeping, and one that I want to jump into with you for a bit here is from Jeremiah 6 in the Old Testament. And here we're given just a little bit of the context, this horrific scene of Jerusalem, the city of God's people, under siege. And as invaders are getting ready to make their assault, we hear this prophetic word where God speaks out against the city because it is filled with oppression. As a well pours out its water, the text says, so she, meaning Jerusalem, pours out her wickedness. Violence and destruction resound in her. Her sickness and wounds are ever before me. And then a few verses later, we see these haunting words from God. From the least to the greatest, all are greedy for gain, prophets and priests alike. All practice deceit. And here's the kicker. They dress the wound of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. Now note that it's mainly the spiritual leaders, the prophets and priests, those with power and influence, who are being called out here. They dress the wound of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. Wow. And we can imagine all the excuses, all the language that gets deployed in situations like this to downplay the wound here, right? You're overreacting. It didn't happen that way. Stop being so sensitive. It's for your own good. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. And so my first main point this morning, I think the lesson here is clear. Anything that downplays or minimizes oppression, harm, or suffering for the sake of maintaining peace or stability is not from God. And as we see in the Gospels, and as we'll see later as we get back into this beatitude, it is not consistent with the way of Jesus. So that's the first form of what I'm calling false peacekeeping. And then the second, equal but opposite sort of form of false peacekeeping is one that we see repeated over and over again in history, and ironically to me, something that many of the great stories of the past century warn us about. So let me show you one example, if we could get the video clip for this morning.
I have brought peace, freedom, justice, and security to my new empire.
Your new empire?
Don't make me kill you.
Anakin, my allegiance is to the Republic, to democracy!
If you're not with me, then you're my enemy.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes. I will do what I must.
You will try.
Okay, so it's Star Wars. But my roommate watched Revenge of the Sith a couple weeks ago, and I saw this scene, and I was like, oh, that's good. I can use that. So... For those non-nerds in the room who aren't intimately familiar with the story of Anakin, our would-be hero, right, who was supposed to bring balance to the Force, to set everything right, he's just turned to the dark side in this scene and become Darth Vader. But did you catch? It was right at the beginning, the first few seconds there. That first line, what he says to justify his decision, right? I have brought peace, freedom, justice, and security to my new empire. So look at the language, right? Is that not the justification of empire from time immemorial? Peace, freedom, justice, security. You had the Pax Romana, that period of peace in antiquity that gets talked about. Right now, well, possibly coming to an end, that's another conversation, but the Pax Americana in the wake of World War II. Nowadays, it's often framed as law and order, right? We have to have law and order, which we do. It's true. And I think we can acknowledge at a very practical level right? That the threat of brute overwhelming force does have the effect of keeping the peace and deterring wars. And even in the Star Wars story, in Revenge of the Sith, Anakin's ascension to the dark side, it came through ending a war, ending this galactic civil war. But the question is, at what cost? Is peace that is enforced through violence actually the peace that Jesus is talking about in the Beatitudes? I want to hit you with one more example from a fantasy story because I just couldn't resist. This one's a little bit more of a deep cut, but I think it's instructive. So Amazon, they've done the Rings of Power TV show, which kind of tells the like prequel story to Lord of the Rings. And there's this moment in the show in season two. I think it's so good. But there's this moment where Sauron, who's the main antagonist, he goes on to become the big chief bad guy, the Lord of Mordor, and all that. Where he defends his quest for power through the forging of these magic rings through which he seeks to take control of the world. And there's this scene where he says, "I wish to heal all of Middle Earth." He's clashing with Galadriel, who's seeking to defeat him, and he says, "No, I don't want to harm you. I want to heal Middle Earth." And that line, "I'm seeking more power so I can fix what's broken in the world," those are the words from a very compelling villain, because it shows that Sauron isn't some, I don't know, he's not like a devil with a pitchfork who just wants death and violence and suffering for its own sake. At least not originally. He wants to heal. He wants to, I'm going to say, enforce a kind of peace. And his vision has this sort of kind of unsettling rationale. There's a logic to it. And as the viewer, you're almost for a fleeting moment kind of on his side, like, oh, like is that what we need to do? Is there any other way? And I think it captures so well the temptation, the seduction of peacekeeping through violence and through domination. And if you know the story of the Lord of the Rings, that temptation is the main through line that runs through the entire thing. Do we use the power of the One Ring to try to save ourselves? Do we choose might to try to bring peace? Okay, so those are fantasy stories. I think they're prescient, though. There's a reason they resonate with us. But how do we see this form of false peacekeeping manifested in the real world? Well, we could look at almost any dictatorship, for starters. These nations that claim to be places of peace but are, in fact, brutally repressive towards their own people. You don't need me to name some of these regimes. But what about on our own shores? This is a picture of an intercontinental ballistic missile called the LGM-118 Peacekeeper. Isn't that interesting? It was produced and deployed by the United States Armed Forces from 1986 to 2005. And it could carry up to 11 what are called Mark 21 re-entry vehicles. So it like splits into 11 different re-entry missiles, each one armed with a thermonuclear warhead about 20 times the destructive power of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima at the end of World War II. And they call this thing the Peacekeeper. Yikes. And of course, it's just one of many, many devastating weapons that America and other nations have developed, ostensibly to keep the peace. It's a direct reflection of this peace through strength mentality, which has in many ways been a guiding principle of America's foreign policy. Now, I'm not trying to get political here per se. This isn't a sermon on the ethics of nuclear armaments and international relations. And I do want to recognize that by bringing this up as a false example of peacemaking, that I'm doing so from a position of privilege as an American. And it's pretty much entirely because of weapons like these that we don't have to worry about a foreign army invading us, right? But for many people around the world, even today, that is a real and active threat. But I still have to ask this question, especially thinking about, you know, what they name this, the peacekeeper. Can this bring about, maybe it can deter certain wars and conflicts, but can this bring about that genuine, deep-seated peace that God desires and that really deep down inside all of us are longing for as well? I don't think anyone's happy about living under the threats of, some of you who lived through the Cold War probably remember this. No one's happy about living under the threat of nuclear annihilation. And so I think the answer is no. Especially if one of these, God forbid, is ever actually used, the answer is definitely no, right? That's not peace. So those are some of the false ways, the false way of peacekeeping, of accommodation, smoothing things over, or enforcing peace through strength. But what does genuine peacemaking look like? Let's return to Jesus. We'll move into part two here to find the true and difficult way of peacemaking. And by the way, I think it's interesting to go back to that position of being a privileged American and talking about this stuff. Jesus, he's delivering, he's teaching the Beatitudes in the context of his people being occupied by a foreign army, right? They're held under the oppressive rule of the Romans. And throughout his ministry, we see it coming up over and over again. The disciples, all these people think that he's come to overthrow Rome, right? And usher in the kingdom of God by force. They're looking for that peace through strength. And over again, Jesus refuses to play that game. He refuses to use the one ring, so to speak. Now, I want to jump into this word peacemaking that gets used. I'm not a Greek scholar, so maybe take this next part with a grain of salt. But I think it's really interesting. I looked up the word for peacemaker used in Matthew here in Strong's Greek lexicon, and I think it's insightful. The Greek word used here, good luck pronouncing that, is I think it's eirenopoioi, peacemaker, and it comes from these two different words. There's eirene, again, I apologize for my interpretation, but typically translated peace, which has this sense of peace of mind, an invocation of peace, a common Jewish farewell in the sense of the health or general welfare of an individual. And then the second piece of it, poieo, which means to make, to do, to act, to cause, to work. It has this sense, sometimes quite literally, when it's used elsewhere in the New Testament, of manufacturing or constructing something, building something. And interestingly, This is the word that's used elsewhere in the Gospels when Jesus speaks of a tree bearing fruit or producing fruit. It's that same word, poieo, to bear, to produce, to create. It's also the same word he uses when he first calls his disciples to follow him and says, I will make you fishers of men. It's that same word, I will poieo you, I will create, produce you as fishers of men. So it's the same word for a tree bearing fruit or for discipleship, make you fishers of men. I already have it up here on the slide, I think, but if you were here for our Shalom series last year, your mind might be making some connections. So here's the coolest thing. I love this. For the corresponding Hebrew word, for Irene, Strong's lexicon actually suggests shalom. I saw that and I was just like, that's it. There it is. Blessed are the shalom makers. Isn't that cool? So this is the beatitude, the shalom makers. At this point, I feel like I can just drop the metaphorical mic and end there. Like, go back to that series, listen to it, and there you go. But it's so beautiful. It's so compelling, especially if we run with this tree metaphor. Like, we are trees that bear shalom, produce shalom as fruit. It just comes forth. It's in our nature. That's peacemaking. It's to bring forth flourishing and health and abundance for everyone. It's profoundly proactive, creative, and generative in contrast to the more passive and static act of peacekeeping, or maintaining some superficial semblance of peace, right? So I want to share just a couple examples of this that hopefully will help us start to tease this out a little bit more. The first is from the life and death of Jesus himself. Let's check out this text from Colossians here. I've cut out certain parts for brevity so I could fit it all on one slide. This is from Colossians 1. And here, Paul is writing, "For in him," meaning the Christ, "all things were created. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." And that last line to me that I've underlined there is just wild when you really start to think about it. Jesus goes to the cross as an act of peacemaking. He doesn't appease or minimize harm for the sake of peace. He doesn't use force for the sake of peace, but instead he puts his own flesh and blood on the line. He achieves peace not through strength, but through weakness, through self-sacrifice, through love. And this is where this text gets pretty sobering and pretty heavy. As I wonder, okay, so what does the path to making peace require? And Jesus shows us that it's through suffering. And to be a peacemaker is, if the cross is any example for us, to step into that gap and suffer for the sake of bringing the separated parties together again. Now, at this point, I don't have time to get into atonement theory. If you're interested on doing a deep dive in that, you can check out the Atonement teaching series we did here at Liminal a couple years ago in 2022, I think. Or we had a short series about what the cross means to me in 2023. But while we're here, I'd still like to pose the question. If Jesus dying on the cross is fundamentally an act of peacemaking, what implications does that have for us as children of God seeking to follow Jesus? Now, I don't often do like calls to action in my teaching, but I would love to see us as a church community just wrestle with this question together, like use this as a jumping off point, making peace by the blood of the cross. What do we do with that? What does that look like for us seeking, endeavoring to be peacemakers? I wish there was a conversation after the service so we could talk about it more, but another time. Maybe if some of you want, we can grab a beer at Topa afterwards and dive into it more. But I don't have all the answers. I do think it means, well, a couple things. One, it is a sobering word because we're following in the way of the cross. To make peace is hard. Usually it often entails suffering, getting hurt. But there's also this grounding hope. If you could go back to the Colossians slide real quick. That peace has already been made. Like in Jesus on the cross, God is showing us, this is my heart to reconcile all things. Right? It is this declaration of we already have peace with God. That's already there. That's already been established. So from that, we can rest in that and move out and work to make peace with confidence and with some sense of very real hope. Again, I don't have all the answers to what all the implications of this are, but I do want to share one man's answer. I'm going to read a quote from one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches. There we go. It's a long one. And as I read, I'm going to go into teacher mode here for a second. I'm a high school teacher. As we read this quote, I'd like you to look out for all the ways that Dr. King rejects peacekeeping, and look for all the ways he champions peacemaking. All right, look at how he speaks to those he is in conflict with, to his oppressors. Here's what he says. We will match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. And do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot, in all good conscience, obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail, as difficult as that is, we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators and violence into our communities at the midnight hours and drag us out on some wayside road and beat us and leave us half dead, and we will still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day we will win our freedom, but we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Dr. King rejects keeping the peace of an unjust system. He says, we cannot follow your unjust laws. He rejects meeting physical force with physical force. And instead, he chooses to love, to suffer, and to turn his enemy into a friend. I think that's it. That's peacemaking. As I was reflecting on this before writing this teaching, again, what does peacemaking mean? What does it take? It occurred to me that all the other Beatitudes, when you think about it, if we take them together as a whole, in a sense, they kind of define and reinforce each other. And I think that's especially true for peacemaking because, I mean, think about it. Authentic peacemaking requires humility, right? Being meek and poor in spirit, setting your own ego and personal ambitions aside for the greater good. Authentic peacemaking requires mourning, stepping into the gap of grief and loss that conflicts creates. It requires a hunger and a thirst for righteousness because it's hard work. You have to want it. You have to fight for it. And of course, it requires mercy, breaking the eye for an eye cycle of retaliation and punitive justice. Authentic peacemaking requires being pure of heart, authentic, sincere, not having any hidden motives. And sadly, often doing the work of peacemaking leads to persecution, right? Being persecuted for righteousness' sake. You have to deal with opposition, often from both sides. Even Martin Luther King, even though he now has a statue on the National Mall honoring his peacemaking work, I didn't know this until recently, but at the time he was assassinated, he was not viewed favorably by a majority of Americans. His favorability ratings were in the tank. As Jesus says elsewhere in the Gospels, a prophet is not welcome in his hometown. So when you go to make peace, when you call out injustice or oppression in a way that seeks a path to flourishing for both sides, you tend to catch flack, not just from the enemy, but often from your own tribe or your own camp as well. So is it any wonder then that history, sadly, is populated much more with those who have sought to enforce peace through empire rather than those who have worked to genuinely make peace for the good of all? It's really hard. I wish I had a different message for you, but that's it. Like it's going to hurt. You're going to suffer if you choose to do this work. But the good news is that it's worth it. Remember how Jesus frames all of the Beatitudes. Blessing, blessed, blessed, blessed. There's blessing in peacemaking because the reward is shalom, flourishing and abundant relationships, lacking nothing. And as we wrap up, this takes us into the last part of this beatitude, for they shall be called children of God. As Catherine and others have stressed, mentioned throughout this series, the Beatitudes are not a to-do list. It's not that being a peacemaker, like if we do that, it qualifies us to become children of God or gives us that right. That's not what this is about. You are already God's child and deeply loved by God. And the heart of the divine, for all who bear the Imago Dei, the image of God, which is all of us, is shalom. It's peace. As Jesus says, they will be called children of God. This is what being a child of God and living within the family of God truly looks like. This is how we're meant to live. So with that, we'll transition into a time of communion. I guess the band can start coming up. And as we do, as we prepare to take communion together, I'd like to offer you some words of comfort from Jesus, which he said to his disciples shortly after the first communion, after originally establishing the sacrament. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid. I confess, when I look at the world, even trying to imagine a path to peace feels, I don't know, unrealistic, idealistic, impossible. It's difficult to be agents of peace in this world until we ourselves have received peace. And that is what is offered to you here at the table. The body and blood of Christ broken and shed for you and for the reconciliation, the atonement, the unification of all things. As children of God, we are one, and this sacrament invites us to taste and see that reality, that truth. So here at Liminal, all are invited and welcome at the table. When you're ready, please walk up one of the inner aisles, take a cracker. We have some gluten-free or glutinous options there, and a cup. The usher will pour the juice for you, which is alcohol-free. Just grape juice into the cup, and then you can use the outer aisles to return to your seat. And then in your own time, whenever you're ready, you can eat the cracker, drink the juice. And after the service, please leave your cup in the coffee bar. Last thing, if it's difficult for you to walk up for any reason, please raise your hand and myself or one of the ushers will bring communion to you. So let me pray briefly, and then we'll come to the table. I could go to the next slide. Jesus, you shared peace around a table of anxiety. Peace with the bread, peace with the wine, peace in the face of the uncertain, peace in the place of pain, sharing food and friendship and words and life. Because you came for a fearful world and found your places around those tables. Amen. My friends, come to the table.